3, 2, 1.
Go!
Here it is! Hey! Good evening and welcome to episode 6 of At Random. My name is Rick Timmis.
My name is John Wordsworth.
I am Jackson Matthews.
Cool, well, in true technical style, we've decided to do things a little bit different this evening because, well, after 5 shows, it does get a little bit samey, doesn't it? So we thought we'd try and introduce Skype into the podcasting mix. Also, partly due to the fact that my throat feels like I've swallowed some kind of thistle bush. And I didn't want to spread that to all the other presenters.
Except for me. Apparently it's all right for me.
Yeah, but you're just Jackson Matthews, aren't you? So it's okay.
Just
Jackson will do. Yeah. whereas the inevitable or the inimitable Rick Timmis is ducking out of the equation because obviously I don't want any of that dreadful lurgy off you, John.
It's all right. I'm pretty sure that Jackson just doesn't do ill, so it's all good.
Not when it's podcast night. No, the show must go on.
So
it's all those nanites in your immune system, isn't it, Jack? Like you just yeah, you've got a rock immune system full of nanites.
I wish I had nanites. That would be a very glamorous thing to tell around.
Super Android Jack.
John, what we got on the menu tonight?
Yeah, I got a few interesting things to talk about this evening. So Google Plus is obviously something which I think deserves a little bit of a mention, and then we can
hot topic.
I'd like to discuss about the Android, where it's going a little bit. I think there's a lot of potential, but it's worried about getting fragmented. Then there's quite a few movements in the tablet industry, which should definitely deserve some mention. And then for deep thought, I thought perhaps some HTML5 and where the future of that's going.
Okay, that sounds pretty good. So in terms of Google, obviously Google have just launched, and it really is, I mean, as we speak at the moment, this is only a few days or a week old or something. I mean, I've been hearing a little bit about it on the Twitterverse. I can't get an account myself because they don't love me enough. I feel very abandoned by Google. But you've got an account, John, haven't you? What have you discovered so far?
Yeah, that in itself was a reasonably strange occurrence. So I found out about Google Plus much like the rest of the world, and I went, it's on Twitter, what's this all about? And then I said, yes, I'd like an invite, please. And they said, ha ha ha, you're in a queue of God knows how many million people that beat you to this box on our website. So I sulked a little bit. I went, fair enough, I'll wait like everyone else. And then somehow a friend of mine got an invite and added me to their friends circle. And I got an email saying you've been added to Gareth's friends circle. And I was like, great, but I can't log in, can I? And there was a little button that said learn more. And when I clicked it, it gave me an account. So I got this feeling that there might have been a bug in the early stages and I wasn't supposed to get an invite about that, just a link to a page. But apparently I got in, so I'm not going to complain. I snuck past the guards.
It's like the equivalent of your friend like opening the side door for you and then shutting it quickly before the bouncers realise.
Precisely. Logically, I thought if I then added my friends to the list, they'd all get invites. So I did that, and then told all my friends, mate, I've added you to my friends list. You should be getting your email soon. And there's not a single person I know that's got that email yet, so I'm guessing...
Tumbleweed. Tumbleweed blowing across the Google landscape for all your mates. Oh, John, you're Mr. Unpopular now.
I'm assuming that they're now in the queue of X million people, and I was just fortunate enough to get an invite before the kind of queue built up and it all slowed down. So I logged in, and let me just get it up here, shall we?
Excuse me?
Well, exciting thing, these podcasts.
I mean, Google Plus, is it that good?
Well, I took a little bit of a look, and what I thought was really odd was that to get more information about Google Plus, it wanted you to give your email address and your password. So I logged in with my email address and password to get to the page that then told me that they were currently oversubscribed and that Google was in a field trial at the moment. And if I gave them my password, they'd keep me posted. Which was completely confused about. Sorry, not if they gave me... If I gave them my email address, they would keep me posted. And I thought to myself, but you've just asked me to log in with my email address. Don't I just want a tick box that says, keep me posted? But anyway, I can't have an account because I apparently am not worthy.
That's Wordsworth, actually. You need to be Wordsworth to get an account. No, so you've probably noticed the redesign of Google's kind of dark grey bar that's appeared at the top of the browser now when you do a search. And then the slightly off-white grey that runs behind the top bar on the search results page. I think that rebranding was to bring it in line with Plus, which Plus is quite interesting. So it's brought a ream of new features to the table. But at its heart, it's kind of an amalgamation of a lot of what Google have already done. So you've got Google Talk on there, which is obviously the Google Talk that we've known and loved for many years. Google Buzz is integrated.
Good old Google Buzz, yeah. that we've known and loved for many years.
Yeah, well, could I just jump in at this point and say, yes, you might have known them and you may well have loved them. I haven't quite heard of them and I'm confused by them. So Google Talk, is that a telephone VoIP thing like Skype?
It can be. I mean, at its heart, it's kind of Skype in the browser, I guess. I mean, it's slightly more focused to text chat, but it also allows video calls, much like Skype, but through the browser.
Okay. So perhaps, I mean, on Ubuntu, there is an instant messenger client called Empathy, which is very much based around the kind of IM experience that you might have. But you can also fire up video and, and conversational stuff. But it's more geared around IM. So perhaps it sounds a bit more like that. Whereas Skype is much more geared around the kind of voice video chat, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you might have seen Google Talk when you've logged into your Google Mail, because it kind of... on the left-hand side, you can chat to your friends. So I think that's kind of where it started. So when you log in, you see your list of contacts who are also online. If you click on their name, a little box pops up. And that is essentially, I think, where Google Talk started. And then they obviously released it as a protocol so you could download the app to your desktop and log in with your Google account and talk to anybody else with a Google account and then start a phone call, which probably came a bit later, and then video calling. So.
Okay. And so what's Google Buzz then?
Google Buzz was Google's attempt to step on the feet of Twitter, I guess, about a year and a half ago, which kind of went incredibly wrong. There was one step, you probably remember the details slightly better than I, Jack.
Well, probably about as well as you do. I mean, I'm not quite sure what they were thinking. Now, as I understand it, they were it was some sort of thing where they made everybody's information public. It was like on everybody, all of your friends got to see, everybody in your contacts list got to see
that
everybody.
Was it. So essentially what they did was they added every single person in your contact list, which obviously, because Google Mail adds anyone that emails you to your contact list, basically to your friends list, so they instantly could see anything you buzzed about.
That was it, yeah, I knew it was something like that.
Oops.
So anyone that ever emailed you instantly became a follower of what you were doing if they clicked the yes, I want to use Buzz button, and therefore everyone could see what everyone was writing. And people were like,
oops,
I just wanted my friends to see it, not all my clients and all my school kids or school teachers or, you know, all these different scenarios where it's just not appropriate.
That's an absolute disaster. I wonder how many people just got fired. Like, you know, they went into work the next day and, yeah, Thompson, into my office. You're gone.
So
that's what those two components are then.
They've introduced...
Carry on then, John.
They've kind of introduced Picasa, the photo upload and sharing service they've had for, again, quite some time.
Yeah, I do love Picasa.
The desktop app as well is really nice, but I mean that's kind of diverging a little bit. But so it's very much, it's a bit like Facebook, the way your photos are on there, but it does have that Picasa web feel, which is quite nice. You know, it's a little bit more engaged, I think, than Facebook as a way of sharing photos.
Okay.
And then you have the ability, and this is, well, there's actually, I suppose there's one more new thing, I guess, and then there's something quite interesting. So the new thing is they've made the ability to add a plus one to anything which you find on the web. So when you're searching Google now, all of your search results have a little plus one icon next to them, and if you click on it, it goes onto your profile as a website that you've plus one'd. So it's kind of a, like you see on Twitter when you see, ooh, plus one, you know, like a, yeah, I like it.
Okay. It's a bit like Stumble, perhaps, or Dig, or something like this.
Yeah, precisely.
Yeah, okay.
But now they come up on your profile page, you can see what a person has plus one'd, and presumably you can probably see a page. None of my friends have plus one'd anything yet, so I can't tell, but presumably there'll be a page where you can see what all your friends have plus'd. So some things will have a higher plus. You know, someone might have, if five people have plus'd a page, it'll be plus five.
Can you plus two things?
No, you only get one, I think, per website.
Terrible.
And then the other reasonably interesting thing they've done is your, where Facebook has a definite friends feel, so you are integrating with your friends. It's a way of talking to friends, not business people, but friends you know from college or grew up with. Twitter's almost the opposite. It's kind of, it doesn't really have a friends concept at all. It just has people that you're following, and that lends itself more to a kind of business or informal relationship. Where Twitter gives you both of those. So you've got, by default, four different circles. They've called them circles. I mean, they're essentially groups, obviously, but dressed up to look pretty. And the circles are friends, family, acquaintances, and following. So those that you're following are basically people that you're reading just their status updates from, much like Twitter. And then friends are people who you would trust to see things that you've posted that are not marked as public.
Okay. That's a good idea, I think. I mean, there's some aspects of Facebook there, aren't there, with those kinds of things, in the sense of, I mean, Facebook has become hugely popular, particularly with things like families and stuff like that, you know, distant relations who want to stay in touch. I know, you know, our family, there's several of us that have got Facebook pages, and Alison, my wife, takes care of our Facebook page, and she's used that to basically let the rest of the family know what's going on. So, you know, it's very much that kind of social. I can see this blend, if you like, of almost kind of the sort of Twitter stumble upon stroke dig stroke Facebook kind of paradigm going on there, if you like. But it almost takes me back as well to some of the early stuff that Google did with its iGoogle interface. You know, you could set up an iGoogle interface and put gadgets on your Google homepage with different things. And I always thought that was quite cool. I quite liked that, you know, being able to have a little notepad and my star sign, because I'm a Gemini, as I like to reiterate on this show, which means that there's a potential for me to be a split person. Or a split personality, but all of those gadgets were quite cool. So I just wonder whether everything being in one place kind of presents itself as quite a nice idea. Has anything happened with Google Wave, or has that been waved bye-bye to, and nobody's talking about that anymore?
That was signed off, I think, at the middle or end of last year. That was officially written off. I wouldn't be surprised if we see some elements of that cropping up again in this Google Plus at some point, though. Well, I mean, the one thing that I particularly liked, and it seems like a minor thing, but was the ability for you both to be kind of typing at the same time, in that real-time view of what the other person's typing, not waiting for them to finish the sentence before you can kick in. So I reckon that feature might win out, even if the rest of it kind of dies in the lay-by somewhere.
Well, interestingly, I mean, I remember, because there was a bit of a controversy in the open source world about this, but about, well, I'm guessing on the timeline, but I'm probably going back around about 18 months, 2 years ago, Google bought an organization called Etherpad. And an Etherpad was an open source application, and it was basically a networked drawing pad that allowed you to share and write and draw and do all of these kinds of things and effectively collaborate around one whiteboard. And then they quickly, Google quickly shut it down and snuffed it out, and then there was uproar, and you know people weren't very happy with the fact that Google had done that. So they then kind of open sourced the code and made it available, and there was all a bit of a kerfuffle around it, and I think it ended up on code.google in the end. But obviously it still exists as a technology, which, you know, I just wonder whether with the ideas of Google Wave and now that technology that they've got, whether that will come to the surface, because that could be quite cool, couldn't it, you know, for interacting with people across the web and being able to draw stuff and collaborate like that. Very interesting.
Yeah, that real-time interaction through a web browser, that's quite an interesting, see what happens with that, would be nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, commercially, I've used things like GoToMeeting, and I've tried things like WebEx. And there's a really great open source collaboration platform called the Big Blue Button. They're based in Canada, and what they create is like a virtual classroom. I can't remember the company behind it now, but if you Google Big Blue Button, you'll find them, something networks that release it. And it's an open source product, but effectively the idea is you click this big blue button and it loads into a web browser a virtual classroom with a chalkboard and a video screen and chat and all of that kind of stuff. And of course you can see each other and see the different cameras and you can interact. And the idea is that distance learning can take place, where the lecturer basically runs a big blue button session and up to 25 students can join in. And again, that kind of, you know, collaborating with your friends when you're sitting at home with the PC and all of those kinds of things. I mean, I think there's just lots and lots of scope for that across the web. And we'll be talking a bit more about some of the technology for doing that in Deep Thought towards the end of this particular podcast as well. So don't let me deflect you from Google Plus. So what, you know, there's a lot of technology that seems to be existing in there. Where's the polish? Where's the shine in this thing, John?
It's kind of, when I saw the screenshots, I was dubious about the look and feel. I thought, oh, another typical Google white page with just, you know, absolutely no real design effort. You know, it's just a white page, a couple of columns.
It's determined minimalism, isn't it?
Yeah, but they have added, they've just made a couple of concessions, I think, to the people that have said you need to add some sort of design. With the little grey bar at the top and the darker grey bar at the very top and then the little row of nice icons. I think it's enough, you know. I think it actually does look, it looks tidy. Facebook had got massively cluttered.
I was just going to say, though, I don't know if the this minimalist, very clean look that they're very obviously very determined to cultivate here. I'm not sure if it works counter to the spirit of a successful social networking site, because Facebook. The first thing you see on Facebook is it looks like there's loads going on, like there's the hustle and bustle of life. Do you know what I mean? It's reflecting that. And on I look at Google Plus and it looks nice. It does look fun. I do want to use it, but it doesn't feel like you're in there with all the other people. Do you know what I mean? Because of this very clean look. I don't know if that's going to work against it gaining any large scale traction.
I think one thing that's a very good point. I think one thing that Twitter users like is the ability to dress up their homepage, and that kind of goes right back to the MySpace era, I guess. I think everyone likes to be able to customise their homepage a little bit, and that's something which it is lacking. I mean, it'd be nice if I could maybe pick a pale colour as my page colour or something, or just a few customisation options, so when someone looks at my profile they're like, oh, that's different, not just another clinical profile on Google Plus.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I mean, I know I'm definitely ultra, ultra lazy when it comes to anything design. I'll just take a piece of tech and I'll use it out the box, however it is, and I don't really care. But even with my Twitter account, you know, that needed a picture of a big motorcycle on it. I had to have it, you know. So it had to be done like that. And you're absolutely right. I mean, a lot of people go to a lot of effort to create that, or to create a personality that's theirs. And you're saying that it's very bland. It doesn't have that. Google Plus doesn't have that kind of facility.
No, it's still got the Google look, you know, the white page, black writing, a couple of pictures, like Google image search, and like you were saying earlier with kind of the widgets that don't exist yet, so you can't customize your profile page or anything. It's just that's the page, which, you know, you can pick which photos go on the top, I think, but that's it.
I'm guessing that's all inevitable, though, that the customization they're going to bring in, because you can already change your background page, can't you, for your home search page. So I'm guessing they're going to bring that sort of thing in here.
I hope so.
So, so in terms of a plus one idea for this Google Plus thing, then, I mean, obviously, they're coming to the market space and they're competing with established social media setups. You know, you've got Skype, which is established for communication. You've got Facebook, which is established for kind of creating your own little homepage, almost like taken over from MySpace. And you've got Twitter for your kind of, you know, your micro blogging type stuff. And those are the three core things. Google must be hoping, are they, that they're going to win customers from those arenas?
Yeah, I guess the value add they have is the convenience that you can do it straight from your Google search. So on the Google search results page is the plus one icon. So you go, oh, that was the page I looked at yesterday. Click. The problem for me is that usually when I'm looking at the search results, I don't know what I want to plus one. It's only afterwards that I know what's good. And then by that point, the plus one button's gone.
Yeah, oh, that's a really good point, because you're not going to plus one something till you've looked at it.
And then it's gone, unless the page put the button at the bottom, which they will probably have next to Reddit, next to StumbleUpon and all the others.
Yeah.
But they've got to do that yet, then, haven't they? So in your mind, from what you've seen so far, okay, now there's a couple of other aspects that Google seems to be launching this like assault on the web of it's almost like an assimilation, a Borg assimilation of the web, because obviously there's the Chrome browser, which has gone through a whole sequence of iterations and now has got its own app store built in there where you can get your own apps on the Chrome browser. We've got all of this kind of Google Plus thing on the Google homepage, so you can kind of have all your social media stuff and all of that kind of thing integrated in there. And of course, we've got the Chrome OS, which is actually, we talked about last time on these new netbooks. I mean, this almost looks like a quite a nicely rounded market lock-in. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of relies on the products taking critical mass, doesn't it, really? Like Buzz didn't and Wave didn't, but I guess there's a certain uptake, and when you go past a certain kind of threshold, you've made it and the curve is going up and it'll keep going up. But if you don't get that initial sort of bump, then you won't get past the critical mass threshold sort of thing. As to whether all kind of three of their main products will do that, or their main ones at the moment, I'm not sure. Obviously, Chrome is great and it's here to stay, and it's won out because it's just, at the moment, the best browser. No other reason, not because it's Google or anything. You know, 5 years ago, Firefox kind of, granted it didn't have the most users, but I think it won out across the web because it was the best browser. Now it's got a bit clunky and slow, but Chrome's here and it works really well and smooth. And now at the moment it's the best browser, so it's certainly taking the market. But with regards to
Plus, I'd take issue with that, John. I'm sorry, but you know, a bit clunky and a bit rah rah is not quite fair to deem that on Firefox. You know, before Chrome entered the market space, obviously Firefox was way in the lead of anything else that was out there and was doing really, really well. And then obviously Chrome came along and tuned the JavaScript engine and all those kinds of things and kind of caught Firefox by surprise, perhaps a little bit, because their focus was really on engineering a space for Microsoft. But, you know, with the latest releases of Firefox 5, the Aurora version, which is coming out, it now outperforms some of the JavaScript benchmarking tests against Chrome's V8 engine with their new Spider Monkey JavaScript engine and so on and so forth. So yes, John, We'll have less of that. Less spilling Firefox it off fashion. As a redundant browser and writing it off into the weeds. Outrageous behaviour.
I look forward to seeing version 5, but version 4 has been a little bit of a fail on my front. The RAM usage and the amount of time I've waited for the constant stream of updates that stop me from browsing in the morning. That was what pushed me away from it in the end.
Okay.
Every day I'd restart it and something wasn't compatible, one of the plugins or something, or the plugins were taking forever to load. And granted, the plugins are obviously not Firefox's fault and things, but at the end of the day, it comes down to the impression of Firefox, regardless of who wrote the product plugins, doesn't it?
Plus, when
was that on Firefox? Was that on? Sorry, Jack. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, when Chrome crashes, it gives you like an "or snap" message, and that instantly puts it ahead for me.
Yeah, I will raise my hands to that, most definitely. That wonderful kind of sandbox threading that they've built into it so that, you know, when one tab crashes, you don't lose the whole browser. Yeah, you know, I can't disagree with that at all. But anyway, you know, maybe that's a debate for another time. Maybe we should see whether we can get somebody on from the Mozilla Foundation and tell them that, you know, you can have a word with them, John, and tell them just what you think and see whether there can be a rebuff.
Well, I'm hoping Firefox 5 does that. So, but back to Plus, I think just in summary then, really, a couple of quick points before coming to a not really sure conclusion yet, so it'd be really interesting to see what our listeners think of this and if they want to either come on to a future show or send us an email, that'd be great. But my final points, I think, one, it's really hard to gauge at the moment because at the moment I have two, maybe three other people that are on Google Plus because no one else has got an invite, so I can't sign in and go, there's no one using it, because they can't. So if that goes on for too much longer, I'm going to probably not go back. So they really need to start getting other people on there, because at the heart, it's a social network. And if I can't be social with people, what's the point in me logging into it, you know? And when I stop logging in, you've lost me, you know? Because I'm going to go back to Twitter or Facebook. That kind of you're in the elite group and got to use it first is already run out. You know, it's only been 2 or 3 days and I'm like, that's great. I can't use it. No one else is using it. I can't talk to anybody. The other thing, which I read earlier, which is quite interesting, was that when you post on your Plus account, it's kind of the Twitter functionality is the default. So what you post is visible to the whole world. And someone was criticising that, saying, well, people don't expect that because they expect from Facebook when you say everyone, you don't mean literally everyone. And they were saying that then, therefore, people that you don't know end up replying to your comments and you kind of didn't realise that you were posting it to the whole world.
Totally.
So I'm not sure where it's going to go yet. And I think they're going to have to play their cards right in the next sort of few weeks, really. I don't think this incredibly slow rollout is the way to attract users. Whether it's in a fall like Buzz or Wave or take off like Google or Chrome, I think we'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I must say I'm sadly enticed, deeply enticed by the whole thing when I just saw it and read about what it was offering with the different functionality that it has. And just, you know, because of the Google Chrome thing and the apps thing, I just sort of thought, wow, there's a lot of convenience of having everything there. One of the things I hate about things like, I mean, one of the reasons why I don't have a Facebook account myself, for example, is because it's just another thing to log into and try to maintain and update. And, you know, I'm already kind of up to my eyes with that. And with things like Twitter, you know, I mean, logging into Twitter as another website to go and do something to, it's totally not convenient. The only reason why I use Twitter is because I've got desktop apps that allow me to just fire something out, you know, through a little Apple. And I was very much enticed by the idea of the fact that, you know, kind of everything would be there. You know, I go to my Google search. That's kind of what I'm doing whenever I want information on something. So I'm there already. And if all those things are all up on the top, or if I just want to say something about this, I can just Google plus it and I can just buzz it, or, you know, I can Google talk with people. And I really, that's very enticing to me. Like you rightly say, I think the difficulty here is everybody else that I talk to, I use a lot of Twitter and Identica. Everybody else I talk to is either on Twitter or Identica. They're in almost completely opposing camps. Most of the people that I know on Identica are, you know, hardened, you know, bearded folk that aren't really going to go anywhere near Twitter because Identica is open source and all of that kind of, you know, rah-da-da-da-da, jazz that goes on. And then obviously you've got the kind of the rest of the world that doesn't kind of care too much about where the software came from that are on Twitter. How am I ever going to get those people over to something like Google? It just isn't going to happen. And particularly not when they do this kind of, well, like, you're included, you're not included. I mean, the very fact that I've gone there and they've said, well, you know, we're a bit over capacity and we're trying it out right now and you're not worthy, it's almost sent me kind of kicking the stones in the sand off in the other direction, going, well, stuff you then, I don't want to play either. So, yeah, I don't know, John. My the Rick Timmy School of Prediction, I don't think it'll make it. No. To be honest with you, I think it's too many of the same things too late.
Yeah, and without the without that imagination, that I still don't think it's cluttered enough. I think it's too clean. I don't think it will capture people's imaginations the way a social network should. I mean, regardless of the amount of people. I mean, when you go onto Facebook, you've got like all these tabs and boxes and windows. I mean, even the adverts are like a reminder that you're in the middle of something. There's there's this buzz on Facebook because you can see stuff going on all over the place, and you've got your people have got their Farmville and all the other games that they're playing. I mean, none of that's present on Google, which seems quite determined to maintain that clean look. And I don't know if that goes hand in hand with social networking.
I agree, Jack.
Fantastic.
Ding dong, ding dong, ding ding, ding dong, dong, ding dong. There's a jingle. Okay. All right. So we'll see what happens in that space. But I think largely we're all pretty much agreed that we kind of like sort of what's happening with this Google Plus as an idea, but we're kind of consigning it to the wave experience, really. Sorry, Google.
We'll have to wait and see if the at random prediction machine is correct.
We already know, but you listeners will have to wait to find out.
Well, yeah, it's my crystal balls that do it. Well, the social media world obviously is fragmented, and I'm looking for a segue now with the word of fragmentation. We keep coming back to this tablet landscape and what's happening and changing there, and the developments are so quick in that market space. It's almost kind of the tablet devices leapt upon us. Apple with their iPad sort of stepped out into the void, and I think everybody else thought that was going to fall flat, and now they've suddenly realized that it isn't. And with 15 million sales in the first 6 months to a year of iPads, everybody's now trying to make them, and everybody's trying to jump on the bandwagon, and the whole market space is getting really odd. Particularly, I mean, I sometimes wonder where Google's getting all this resource from, because, you know, they've done this Google Plus thing, they've got the Google Chrome browser, the Google App Store, they've got obviously the Google Android operating system, the Chrome operating system. You know, is somebody biting off too much cake? Because the Android device market space is going really... John, I think it might be out of control. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, there's some really crazy stuff happening at the moment, and it makes it really difficult to develop for Android as a platform, actually, and that's not going to entice people to bring more apps to Android. But they obviously released Honeycomb not many months ago, and that was kind of brand new fantastic tablet experience, and you've now got all these kind of flashy things where you can, they're called fragments, where you can split the screen in two, much like you see on the kind of iPad list view on the left and the detail view on the right, so you can scan through your objects and have one of the objects open all at the same time. But by developing them as fragments, you can then use the same fragments on a phone to show your list view on one screen and then your detail view on the next screen. So you haven't got to code it twice, because you've just basically coded the two different views, and on the tablet you show them side by side, and on the phone you show them one after another. And you think, oh, that's fantastic. That's a great way of making it so you can code for both and only have to worry about one. Similarly, they've put kind of an action bar at the top, which they've kind of tagged as this global bar, where you'll be able to then keep your menu items that are going to run across your app. And on the phone, I think the idea is they'll kind of degrade into one of the buttons at the bottom, so they don't take up any screen. So you can push the button at the bottom of the screen and the menu pops up. But on a tablet device, the menu will be at the top all the time, because you've got the screen space to give you that quick access. And you think, oh, that's great. So you code your app and you get right into development. You think, yeah, this is great, all this compatibility with both a tablet and a phone. And then you say, right, I've built it. It works on the Motorola Zoom as our test device now. Let's see how it looks on a phone. Android API 11, which is the honeycomb, isn't available for the phones. When will it be available? Never, apparently. It's not going to be available. So you think, obviously there'll be another API at some point which will be available, but there are no plans at the moment to bring Honeycomb to the phone. And you think, well, you've just encouraged me to use it so that it works on both phones and tablets, but the operating system doesn't support phones. And then you go back and I started looking deeper into what phones... You know, I assumed, coming from the Apple kind of developer point of view, that there would be a little bit of a backlog in people upgrading their devices. So at the moment, we still support, you know, we try and support version 3 in the apps, unless you've got something which needs version 4. But when version 5 comes out, in my head, kind of ignore version 3 and then just worry about people still running 4 and 5. But that's not the case with Android,
yeah.
Because it's not down to Google to push Android out onto the phone devices, but it's down to the phone manufacturer and sometimes the operators. So if say Verizon or HTC decide we're not going to put Android 2.3 on the HTC Desire, which was a worry at one case, then they'll never get it. And you think, well, that means you have to support everything right back to maybe sort of 3-4 years ago, in case there are handsets out there that have never had upgrades. And I think that's terrible that a new version of Android comes out, has all these great features, but now we've got to wait maybe a year for my handset operator to actually put it on, by which point there'll be another one available. And they may never decide to put it on, because obviously all these handset operators have put their own UIs on top of it, which they then have to bring in line, so they've added their kind of... They've taken Android, added their layer on top. If their layer isn't compatible, they might never upgrade your Android version and fix the bugs that are there.
This is not good news for the market space at all. And I mean, I know that I mean, it seems that there seemed to be some alignment. I mean, what you've just explained confuses it a little bit more. But in my head, I got to the point where I understood that we effectively had Android 2.3 Gingerbread, which was the mobile phone handset OS, and that we had Android 3 Honeycomb, which was the tablet OS. I wasn't aware that there was this development paradigm that allowed you to effectively that was creating these constructs that would effectively work across the devices, yet are not supported across the devices. That just seems to me to be complete nonsense. First of all, that is a big problem, because you've got effectively two different, almost completely different architectures for the developers to develop against, which means twice the workload. And when you're competing in the market space with Apple, the iOS operating system does allow you quite easily, and I know because we've obviously done it, or you've done it, that you know, you can easily develop one application that will sit across the phone or the tablet. Android needs to do that. But But also, of course, we've got all the legacies going back to 2.0, 2.1, 2.2. And then I discovered just recently, looking at some of the plethora, and it really is a complete plethora of tablet devices that are just almost spilling onto the marketplace from everywhere. It's almost like every imbecile director of tech company boardroom is suddenly, you know, I sometimes wonder whether company directors just wander around the world in this, like, kind of slightly divorced from reality, as though they're not, you know, they're probably being perhaps too paid a little bit too much money and spending too much time on the golf course, so they're not paying attention to the world around them. And then all of a sudden, when they suddenly see, oh, look, everybody's buying tablets, everybody's, you know, sitting at the board table going, make tablets, make tablets. So all of these tablets are being poured into the market space. You've got things like, we did a review of tablets back along, but the eTouch, which has come out, which is an Android 2.1 operating system. So you think, great, oh, that should be a really cool device for £139, you know, maybe buy one of those for the kids and they could use that, except that the Android marketplace is not compatible with it because of the adjustments that the manufacturer has had to make, compromises with the Android 2.1 operating system because of the device specifications. Apparently the device spec was not high enough. So yes, you can get it with a few apps, but there is no app store and there's no anything else on it. And to get the app store, you have to hack about with it. And it's like, you know what? Hang on, what's going on here? And it's turned into a complete free-for-all with all of these divergent things going off in all different directions. And it's going to destroy destroy that market space for any competition, and it'll allow Apple to just totally dominate that market space.
The problem is, you just don't know what you're going to get when you buy an Android device. Is it going to be Honeycomb or not? And you have to worry about these things, because you might never get Honeycomb on your tablet. You're running Android 2.3, which they've even admitted wasn't really made for tablets.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've got the ViewSonic ViewPad 7, and I think that's running Android 2.2, I think, which is a superb little device. You know, it's pretty cool. I mean, it's... it is really nowhere near the iPad, in terms of really is, you know, furlongs ahead the iPad is as a device. And, you know, in the main, it's as I've got used to using it, I've thought, yeah, I quite like some of it. But then it's got all these clunky little oddities with it now, you know, like things from the marketplace don't load correctly, or certain apps don't work in horizontal mode, and those things are just really irritating, when you're trying to use the device, and there are things like that, and maybe that's that that kind of freedom that's available in the kind of open source market space, which is, well, Linux and Linux distributions have suffered with this tremendously, with all of these different derivatives and so on and so forth. And I think Canonical and Ubuntu have started to unite some of that into a more polished user experience. But, you know, Google's responsible for this OS. And what's with this situation with Motorola, of course, because they give Motorola the Honeycomb source code early and aren't releasing it to the other manufacturers.
Yeah, I think this is them looking at what's going on and realizing that most of these devices are going to die like disco. So they've got this I don't think it's their definitive tablet in terms of what we're going to see in the future, but it's certainly they've chosen it as their flagship, because they're thinking along the same lines as Apple. I don't think they want to release a bunch of different OSs for a bunch of different devices and Androids take over the world. I think what they'd rather do is similar to what Apple's doing, and have like one or two devices running a dedicated OS that actually has a chance of performing. And everything we've been seeing up until now is, I don't want to say a testing phase, but it's got elements of that. They're seeing how it performs in the marketplace, seeing on which devices it does best on. And I think we'll see a successor to the Motorola Beastie in future. Something much more powerful.
Yeah, I think you might be right on the money there, Jack. That makes huge commercial sense, what you've just said.
Twice in a day.
yeah, Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily agree. I don't agree with it, but it, because I think I'd like to see the Honeycomb operating system opened up to the market to see what people can do with it. But and in some ways, I'd like to see the, I'd like to see it unified so that we just have one operating system, like Android 3, and that one operating system is capable of functioning across the tablet, across the phone, and dealing with the different device specs. I think that would be a better way of doing it, and force the onus back on the manufacturer, really, to say, look, you know, you are going to have to spec a machine to this level if you want to use the operating system, and if you're not prepared to build it to that level, then, you know, then you're going to have to go and use something else like QNX.
Just want to touch on one more point that you made quickly before we wrap this up. But the marketplace is also a cause of fragmentation, and in two senses. One, there's the Google Android marketplace, but in the attempt to be open, there are obviously also a number of other marketplaces you can use to purchase Android apps from, assuming your device allows it. I think some are locked down to just the marketplace. So you can also buy your apps through the Android marketplace, for instance, and other marketplaces. So if it isn't allowed on one, you quite often see these apps appearing on others. Like there was a fairly fancy emulator that I downloaded on mine. It was free for a week to celebrate the fact that it got back onto an app store after Google kicked them off, because it was a, you know, Super Nintendo emulator, and I don't know, it broke some of the terms and conditions somehow. Not for being an emulator, but for something else. But that's kind of fragmenting it in one direction, so there's no longer a central place where apps live, and certain apps only live on certain marketplaces. And then the other cause of fragmentation is that you log into the marketplace, and A, you see a list of apps, and they all look great, but 10% of them won't work on your device, 10% of them are very inadequate on your device, and then the rest have varying levels of kind of functioning on your device. Because some of them will use some native code, because you can load kind of JNI native code in, and sometimes that just isn't compatible because they're using some low-level core that your device doesn't support, so then that won't work. And then there's the kind of next level up, and they just don't support the right API, or they're quite old apps made for a phone, so they're built for a certain range of resolutions, and your tablet's bigger than that, so it doesn't know what to do, and all the objects get sort of thrown around horribly, and you can't use the app anymore because you can't tap the OK button. And then you end up with your apps, some of them which are kind of phone apps and some of them are tablet apps, but there's no way of differentiating between any of these different types of apps. There's no way of listing which ones will or won't work on my device, which ones are actually meant for a phone, so I shouldn't bother downloading one on a tablet, or which ones are meant for a tablet, so I can actually show off this device that I've bought. There's no way of telling until you download a handful and see which ones don't install or don't work or do work, or you're never really sure, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's not really acceptable as a, you know, the marketplace for these things needs to be really simple, and it needs to give people the information. I mean, in some ways it almost needs to, it almost, what's needed is almost some kind of, like device compatibility database in the back end, so that your device self filters the market space and only shows you the apps that are suitable for it. You know, maybe the making the onus on the manufacturers to you know, put some specs together or something like that, so that that then sits in the marketplace. You know, I mean, for example, I downloaded an IRC client and loaded it onto the ViewPad, and really it was just totally unsuitable, and I would much prefer to have just not seen that there, you know, rather than end up with it on the phone and now got to take it off on the tablet, then you've got to take it off and all the rest of it. So, and I think that's just going to disappoint the customers. It's going to leave them with a nasty taste in their mouth. And then they'll go up to the Apple store and see, you know, what it's like on an iPad, and wonder why on earth they were buying an Android device in the first place. Interesting one.
So, conclusion? Future of Android?
Well, I think for me, I think that Google's got a really, really great opportunity in the market space here with the Android OS and with what they're doing, and I think they need to really bring that home, bring it back into the fold a little bit more, and offer just a bit more of a bit more control around it, and I think that will probably save it. If they don't do that and leave it to be a free for all, I think it's going to turn into a disappointment for many customers, and that will mean that the customers will vote with their feet and they'll go somewhere else.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I also think that Google's not going to let that happen. I think they're going with this survival of the fittest approach, and we'll see a much stronger product from them once the dust settles and the lesser tablets have all died a death.
Yeah. Cool. Well, talking about Google and their tablets and apps and so on and so forth, that brings us on to the app review for this show, where we can take a look at the different things that we've discovered on the App Store. And let's pass this over to you, Jack. What have you got for us this week that you think's a bit groovy?
Well, this may be of more interest to me than it is to most people, me being a graphics guy, but I found this an incredibly useful utility that until recently I didn't think they had anything like this. I work with Photoshop files, PSD files, quite a lot, and sometimes I want to either look at them on the iPhone or I want to show them off, or for whatever reason, but there's no facility for looking at it. So you can guess where I'm going with this. This is basically an app called PSD Viewer, and it can basically preview PSD files. But the really cunning thing about this, if I open up my Dropbox, most of you are going to have heard of Dropbox. It's basically for syncing files with each other, with different devices, but you've got. And if I just come into that a moment. Now, on Dropbox, I can see all my PSD files, and I can open them up in PSD Viewer straight from the Dropbox. So if I pick one of the smaller files, because it does take a few moments, let's have a look. Mm-hmm. Here we go. If I pick up this small one of my little cartoon knight.
Okay.
I'll just let that open up a moment. And once that's opened up, you can basically you can view it as normal, and it tells you unable to view file in Dropbox, but if you tap the button in the corner and tap PSD view, it opens up straight in there. And this is really easy and quick to do. It just ties straight into that, and then you get a preview of it, which you can zoom in as closely as you'd like. But a really clever feature, I thought, is it has options for archiving your images to the photo library on your phone. So if you want, you can convert it to an image file into the regular photo gallery, which I thought was just the icing on the cake, really. In addition to, you can not only being able to view the PSD file, you can also send it to somebody if you want to send them a quick preview of something that you're working on. And I just thought that was incredibly useful. A little bit niche. I mean, for graphic people, most interested to them, but because most people aren't going to be working with PSD files. But I just thought it was really, really handy and what I needed in a pinch, really. There's a light version, but for 59p, the full version is well worth getting if you have any interest in doing this kind of thing on your phone. So that's well worth the money.
So that integrates with Dropbox, and obviously with your local photo album. So it's obviously doing a conversion there from PSD file into some sort of JPEG or something.
Yep.
But you said that so if I was to email you a PSD file, and mm-hmm. that comes into your email client, does the app integrate with that as well?
It's a good question. I'm not sure that it would. I mean, as far as I know, you can only open it from a Dropbox, because I'm not sure that this is off the top of my head here. I'm not sure that the iPhone itself knows what to do with a PSD file once it gets in an email. I mean, John, do you know anything about that one?
I think it should be fine. So what the app is actually utilising is the ability which they added in iOS 4 for an application to give you the opportunity to open up a file in a different application. So whenever you download something even if you download something like a PDF, if you have other PDF viewers installed, then a little pop-up menu opens up saying, do you wish to open this file in
iBook, I've seen that,
or Goodreader? And so in the same respect, if you get this file through email, it should also pop up that same menu.
Oh, so you can do the same thing?
Yeah, so you'll be able to open up a PSD straight from your email in this PSD viewer.
So yes, Rick, forget what I just said. You can.
So that, yeah, that would be really cool, because in terms, you know, I was just sort of thinking, you know, from an art, from a kind of like requiring the services of design, which obviously we've talked about in the past, Jack, then, you know, being able to get your PSD file and open it up and look at it as the end recipient, that's really useful, because you can't do that on like the iPad or something like that. Normally I would have to get it opening in GIMP, the open source graphics program, that I would use to look at PSD files. So that is that is really quite cool if it integrates like that. And I've seen what you're talking about, John, with PDFs as well, because I do very often make the distinction between some PDFs I'll save them into iBooks because I want to keep them for later and read them later on, and other things I can just open in Docs to Go or whatever. So I suspect it'll work the same way. But the Dropbox integration is really great as well, particularly for somebody who's working on lots of design, as you say, Jack, because you can just drop all your files in your Dropbox folder and you've got access to them whenever you need them.
From anywhere, exactly. Yeah, that's fair. That sounds pretty cool. I'm on 59p, full version of that, but there's a light version if you don't want to get your feet wet too soon.
Sounds good as what it says in the tin.
Well, 59p, I think you should just... For 59p, you should just go for it, shouldn't you, really? I mean, I think at the end of the day, you know, I think it's important to remember that there needs to be some reward in some ways, I think, for the developers by spending, you know, it is pocket change, isn't it? But if enough people spend that pocket change, it makes it worthwhile the developer making something else or developing enhancements to the product or whatever. You know, so you need to give them, you know, at least buy them a cup of coffee, don't we, really? John, what have you got?
Cool. Well, all this talk about social media and social interaction, I'd like to bring out a bit of an old stable app, actually, that I've been using for a couple of months, on and off. And it's I'm not going to lie, it's mostly used at about 5 o'clock when I'm kicking back in the lounge playing some games. But I've still got some conversations going on my PC, and I want to carry them on while sneakily playing a little bit of, say, Little Big Planet 2 downstairs. So, there's an app called IM Plus, which is all-in-one messenger, and it's simply an IM client which you can use on your iPad or your iPhone. It's got a couple of nice features. So it has a built-in browser, so if someone sends you a link, you can tap it without having to leave the app. And it also seems to sign in to the server, so you get push notifications. So even if you minimize the app and move it away, at which point it stops running, it keeps you signed in for 10 more minutes. So then if someone sends you a message within the next 10 minutes, you get a little push notification pops up saying, you know, Rick sent you a message. You tap on it and the app loads up and shows me the message so I can continue using my iPad while chatting in the background, which is quite nice. It's not particularly, there's not a massive amount to say. I mean, I'm using the free version, which doesn't seem to be hampered in the slightest, apart from having some adverts on it, which is my way of buying the developer coffee. I did look at buying it. I think I'm fairly confident that now the pro version is more reasonably priced, but at the time, the pro version was kind of £5.99, and the free version, which did everything, as far as I could tell, was free, just had a little advert at the bottom, so it was quite a steep jump for me to just donate a little bit to the developers. But yeah, I mean, it supports sending files over the network. I'm trying to pull up the account list so I can see what it supports. But it supports signing into AOL, MSN, Twitter and Facebook, which is quite nice. So they're kind of...
Cool.
It's fairly basic Twitter integration, but the Facebook chat's quite nice if you use Facebook. Yahoo, Google Talk, Jabber, ICQ and MySpace. But it's just a central place where you can log into all of those chat providers and keep your conversation going on the move, or if you're stuck on the bus or something and you're a bit bored and you want to chat to some friends, then it works just as well on your iPhone, so you can just pull it out and have a play, really.
If I buy this one on the iPad, if I had an iPad, would I get it for the iPhone as well, or is it a separate app?
That's a very good question, actually. I assume, from what I believe, it is actually a universal app. So if you buy it once, then you'll get it on both.
Yeah.
I should be able to tell you that incredibly quickly.
Because it seems like the kind of app that would... that it seems only fair to run on both at the same time. So if you get like, get for one and get for all, but...
Yeah, there we go. So it's a universal app.
Oh, good. That's right.
It's still $9.99 for the full version, which is ad-free. And while I believe it does add a few features, I've been using the free one for a few months now, and there's nothing to complain about it. So I don't know why such the steep step up from free to £6 just to get rid of the adverts. But
Okay.
I've got to say, I do really hate adverts, so I don't know, it'd be touch and go with me.
Oh, it sounds pretty cool. The 10 minutes in the background, what happens after 10 minutes? Does it just kind of sign out from the IM server, or...?
Yeah, I was just reading the IM Plus Pro version that says it keeps you logged in for a week, 7 days after closing the application, so I'm not sure if that's another one of the differences between the free and the light one.
Yeah, okay, because I mean that seems a bit 10 minutes to only, you know, you're signed in for 10 minutes, it'd be easy to, you know, lose the thread of a conversation, because 10 minutes can fly by, can't it, you know, even in the midst of an IM conversation when you're doing other things as well.
I'm wrong,
so.
Now, sorry, it's now I think this has changed, but it's now, it says 7 hours, so on the light version it keeps you signed in for 7 hours, on the pro version it's 7 days, so I guess with the pro version it's kind of like you're always online. If someone wants to talk to you, it will let you know.
Yeah.
But yeah,
okay.
I mean,
what I mean, I
was just going to say, definitely worth checking out if you like to do your online talking, online chatting and stuff. I only log it into Facebook, Google, and MSN, but it works a treat. And that's IM Plus, and it's available. There's a free version and a paid version from the App Store. Just check out our website for a link at random.org. So
sounds cool. So, well, I've been playing around with... I've been looking around for an app for a little while, and I genuinely had been kind of kicking around to see whether there was anything that would do this. And obviously with the iPad, you get the standard note-taking tool, the standard notepad that comes with it. And in actual fact, that is a pretty sufficient tool in itself. You know, you can type letters, type blogs, email them to yourself, and keep notes and to-do lists and stuff like that on it, which is absolutely great. But I very often found myself just wishing, maybe because the iPad is so tactile, just wishing that I could doodle on it, you know, or I could just draw or scribble on the notepad, or maybe I could just, you know, separate two bits of text and draw a line between them. So I started looking for something like that, and I came across this app called Notes Plus. And now, there was no free version to try it. It was do it or bust, really. So £2.99 for the app. So I went to the website, and I was really impressed with that. The whole, you know, the polish of the website was just fantastic. They've done a really good job of laying that out and presenting a really polished, professional image. And the reviews that it got were really good. And in the end, I thought, yeah, okay, I'm gonna pay the £2.99 for this, and downloaded it. And it is an absolutely awesome app. I've been so impressed with it. It basically allows you to draw and doodle on the pad, as well as write letters with your finger, just like you write in a pen. Or you can you can write type text in there as well. And I even actually managed to draw a little doodle of like a cartoon drawing of Jake, my deerhound lurcher, and Jake's all kind of hair. And as you've heard me say before, I can't draw for toffee, like, you know, I'm absolutely rubbish at it. But I fiddled around on this thing, just drawing little lines for a bit, and sure enough, I got these shapes of little lines, and I thought, crikey, that looks a bit like Jake's head. So I just carried on, and after a bit, I'd drawn this body and legs and stuff like that on him in like a sitting down pose, and then I was playing around with drawing some stuff, and it really impressed me, the kind of just the control, the depth of control that you get with your finger. You know, like if you imagine like a stylus or a pencil on a paper, obviously gives you some really fine control, and it gives you really great control like that when you're drawing. It also allows you, it's quite intelligent in the way it makes decisions about things. So if I wanted to draw a box around something, it will allow me to draw the box, and when I get to the end of drawing it, it'll pop up a choice, like a little menu, and it'll say, don't select this object. So it says, it looks like you've just tried to select some text. If you want to, you can just drag the text about. But if you click this button that pops up that says, don't select, it will just leave it as a drawing. Or it will say, delete. So it allows you to delete that section of the page if you want. And it also does shape detection. So if you draw a square about the right size and make a reasonably decent job of it with your finger, it will go, you look like you're drawing a square. Do you want me to put a proper square there? And if you just say, do detect as a shape, it will just put a proper legit square or an ellipse or a triangle or whatever.
That sounds pretty patronising, to be honest.
Yeah? Well, for me, I just found it really great, because it's like, yes, I want that to be a circle. So, for example, drawing object diagrams. I've drew several circles and I've written some text up. Yes, I do want those to be circles. And then it pops the circles around them and then allows me to draw the arrows between them. And all of a sudden, I can draw like a design pattern on there, and then I can write some text about it, and all of a sudden I've got like a picture's worth 1,000 words, isn't it? And I've got this kind of doodle sketch with bits and pieces on it. £2.99, I've been really impressed with it. I think it's worth every penny. You can then export what you've drawn as a PDF and email it to people. You can keep as many notes as you like and as many notebooks as you like with as many note pages in as you like. So lots of flexibility there as well. And it comes with a whole bunch of tutorial videos on the site to show you exactly how to use things. And it's all gesture-driven. So, you know, you can two finger zoom and that makes it go full screen, or hit two fingers on the page and drag down allows you to draw the move down the notebook. You can zoom on a particular area, and it's just clever, really nice. So that's Notes Plus, and the website is notesplusapp.com. obviously there's links in our show notes for that. I've been really, really impressed with it. I'm giving it 9 out of 10 so far. Probably the best app I've come across so far.
Looks really good. I mean, I think I use the kind of notes app, the regular boring notes app on the iPad and the iPhone a lot more than I thought I would. Because I got Pages and thought, that's great. Pages now, I've got something I can properly write in. But I think I use the kind of notes app quite a lot. So I could imagine something like that, but with more features and the ability to have multi-page notebooks and all the fancy kind of shape interaction being really good.
Jack's got a look of disgust. Never.
No. I was just jesting, because it's like you're trying to. You made it sound like you were trying to draw a square, and then along comes the computer and say, "Oh, are you trying to draw a square? Here, let me do it for you."
A little bit like Clippy, the little Microsoft Clippy paperclip thing.
And you right-click on him and shut him down mighty fast, because he's basically telling you you're not good enough. So you need him, he's saying, we don't need him.
You look like you're trying to commit suicide. Would you like assistance?
With a paperclip.
Yeah.
Love it. So 3 more great apps reviewed by the At Random team. This might be a good time for us to get Jerry in.
Yeah, let's speak to a professional.
Absolutely, yeah. Okay, press the button, John. Hiya, lads, it's Jerry, Mank Techie. Yeah, how's it going? Yeah, right. Listen, lads, I just wanted to call in and tell you I've been messing about with that Ubuntu Linux recently. Mrs. Techie had problems with her Windows Vista machine. It's got that user access control mechanism working on it, and effectively it just knackered up the whole machine. We tried to install Xamp on it to play around with some these newfangled Chrome apps, you know, web apps, like, so we was trying to set them up, So we needed a XAMPP installation putting on Windows machine. Anyway, it complained about it couldn't install it somewhere for some reason, and UAC controller went buggered up. So what we tried to do, we decided we'd try and install one of these dual boot Linux DVDs, so that we could put an Apache web server environment on laptop and run these applications. Anyway, Jerry at Manktekim, I was struggling with partition tables and I couldn't figure out what were what, so I just told it to just start afresh. I didn't think it'd matter too much, really, about how you splice the disk up, really. Anyway, well, that wiped out Windows Vista before we knew where we was at, and now we've got a machine with Ubuntu Linux on it and nowt else. So that's totally just mashed me melon, that, really. Mrs. Techie's absolutely gone ballistic with me because of, all programs that she knew on it. But anyway, we've been mucking about with this Ubuntu, there's nowt else for it, because we didn't have no backups. Can you believe it? Man, Techie didn't take no backups, but that's how it is, isn't it? You never think it's going to happen to you, do you? So you just think, I'll be all right. Anyway, no backups, no nowt, so that we're gone. Mrs. Techie's going mental. You're smashing me melanin, she said. You're just doing me Sweden. I've got stuff on eBay that I'm trying to sell, and you're wrecking it for me. So I said to her, well, I'm sure eBay can work just as well on Ubuntu machine. Anyway, we've been trying to mess around with that and fiddle about with it. I tell you what, lads, it's a bit confusing because interface is completely different. They put menus at the top and slidey inny outy things on left hand side with all these funny buttons. But once you get used to them, what programs are what, it is a bit easier. It's not so bad. It's got some good funky things with it, and it works pretty good on machine. It's definitely one to try. Anyway, that I know it's an odd way of doing a review, but I just thought I'd put it into you. I know you like to hear about things at random. So there you go. You can get it from Ubuntu.com. I think it's called Ubuntu Linux. Natty Narwhal 1104. And you can go download the DVD and install it on your machine. Dual boot. But make sure you do a backup of your PC first of all. And understand what you're doing with partition tables. Otherwise you'll wipe your machine out. Right. Have a good show, lads, and say hello to all your listeners, and we'll speak very soon. Take care now. Don't let it mash your melon. Jerry Manktekim out. What? I mean, that totally speaks to my heart. What he's just talked about there totally speaks to my heart. I come across this experience time and time again, although I must say it's not very often I make a mistake like that. But there we are. I don't know what to say, really, practice makes perfect. But yeah, I'm a big lover of Ubuntu, and I'm delighted that Jerry is... had a really good experience with that, because I think it's a great operating system. But I maybe take a little bit care with Mrs. Techie's PC. Certainly, I wouldn't do that with Alison's PC for fear of pain of death.
Definitely. Some surprises are a bit too much.
Right. Okay. So, well, obviously, we've been talking a lot about tablets today, haven't we? Now, we've got a few more things that are coming into the marketplace here, because the BlackBerry team, RIM Technologies, have launched the BlackBerry Playbook.
This is BlackBerry's killer device, isn't it? This is the one that's going to dominate the market, if my research is correct.
Certainly they are. They're having a lot of fun, or they've certainly got plenty of budget on national television, because they're spending a lot of time advertising this in between soap operas and stuff like that, with really quirky little adverts as well, saying things like, because the Playbook is powerful with its dual core, whatever it is, that means it can play Flash in a browser. and insinuating that nobody else can do that, which is fine, great, so you can play Flash. the market space, the advertising's wonderful, but the market space hasn't received it that well. It's been getting some pretty poor reviews.
I must say, the Flash adverts just had me in stitches for all the wrong reasons. And you got the Flash.
Oh,
like,
no,
we are
godly,
we do Flash. Just like every other Android tablet that exists.
Yeah.
That's our unique selling point. That is our one thing we do really well, and that's Flash. And you can only get that on every other tablet on the market.
I think, I mean, I have been saying this for a while, but I think that BlackBerry, as a brand, has really suffered a lot. And I think that RIM are just making loads and loads of mistakes, mistake after mistake after mistake. They entered the market space way back in the day with the BlackBerry phone device, and they kind of went. I mean, it's always over the top, totally over the top marketing from BlackBerry right from the very outset. I remember my first experience of it was going to a show and seeing this, walking into the show, and there was this kind of BlackBerry Vodafone stand as you entered with this enormous, like, 8-foot plastic mobile phone with hands and a funny smiley face on it. And it was rabbiting on about email or something. And there were these guys in pinstripe suits with red ties, you know, the really sharp, £2,000 vacuum cleaner salesman telling you about how you could get email on your mobile phone. And what was great about this email on your mobile phone was that it was push email. Which I never understood. I always thought to myself, well, isn't that just the same as setting your mobile phone to just pull your email in every 5 minutes? Doesn't that achieve the same thing? What's so special about it? But everything was about, you know, getting out there with the brand and so on and so forth. And then off they went, partnered up, and they'd come out with BlackBerry Enterprise devices and plugging into Exchange and appeal to the business market and so on and so forth. But as soon as the kind of the smartphone came out with the touch screen, so iPhones and that sort of stuff, BlackBerry just seemed to completely lose the plot and go off in all kinds of odd directions. And I think they're doing the same thing again here. They're off at some way weird tangent with some, another fragmented device. I mean, this QNX operating system doesn't make sense. And the device, they're known for email, guys.
Yes,
they're known for email on mobile devices. Speak to me, Jack. What's going on with the playbook?
Yeah, I understand they've taken the controversial step of not having the email on there.
You can only receive email if you own a BlackBerry phone.
Yeah. It's
Which
kind
is
of like having a car that can only take you to the beach if there's a caravan on the back of it.
Exactly. I mean, that is just ridiculous, totally ridiculous. It doesn't make any sense at all.
What I love is the way they've tried to make it sound like, oh, no, that was a deliberate choice. Now, come on, people, catch up with us, because we're trying to tell you something important here. This is deliberate, and then they try and tell you why. But I think that's quite adorable.
But then the next thing, of course, is that it's the same situation with your calendar.
Mm.
So if you want your calendar to work, well, you've got some restrictions. See email. The restrictions on email apply. So there's no email, there's no calendar, unless you've got a BlackBerry phone device, which, well, you know, I've been singing for a while that that's not going to happen. Their app store is virtually, it's a little bit like, you know, well, there's got a few apps in it, you know, the same way that the Sahara Desert's got water in holes. Few and far between, aren't they, really? It's all a bit sparse. But what they've done, which is, I think, is just a stroke of pure, well, some might call it genius, but they've decided that they're going to enable some of the Android apps to run by deploying an Android emulator to run Android apps on the QNX operating system. I mean, that's just... it might be some kind of genius, but that's insane. So you're going to get, you know, you're going to get this fairly substantial piece of hardware and load it with QNX, which has got no applications running on it. So then you'll create an Android emulator to run the applications on. What's QNX doing there? What's that all about?
I suppose actually at the end of the day, it's probably not too far-fetched. Assuming they're both running on a similar kind of Linux standing, on top of that, Android is essentially just a Java virtual machine, isn't it?
Mm.
So I guess it's not so much going to be emulating an Android tablet in the same way that Wine is not an emulator. It's going to be running them natively, but on a different virtual machine. So it's not going to be too much of a performance hit, I'd imagine. They obviously realise they're in a sinking ship and need more apps.
But why go to all that trouble? Why go off on this obscure trip of the QNX operating system, which, I mean, I haven't looked into the background of this, so I'm probably not in a position to comment, but my understanding of it is that it's a Unix derivative, and it uses a microkernel, a little bit like the Apple Mac type of thing. So, but you know, why go in that direction when you've already got Android out there? I mean, maybe it's as a result of the fact that they can't get Honeycomb. Maybe Motorola have got Honeycomb and BlackBerry or RIM have seen that Android 2.2 is simply not a good enough, or Gingerbread's not a good enough operating system for that device, and they've found themselves boxed into a corner by the very thing that Jack was talking about. Commercially, they've found themselves trapped, so they've had to go for QNX. Maybe that's it.
I mean, on the one hand, if they... I've got sort of two almost diverging thoughts come to mind, but on the one hand, this playbook would have been designed and theorised a year and a half, maybe 2.5 years ago, at which point they might have recently gone, oh, bollocks, we haven't got any apps and we listen to, like, we're going to get that many. Let's try and get some Android apps running so that we can say on our adverts, 500,000 apps available. On the flip side, maybe they've kind of done what you were saying, and maybe they've gone, well, we want to run Android apps and we want something a bit like Android, but we want it to be our own as well. So they can tap into that Android marketplace, which is pretty much the only major benefit for using Android. You know, if you're a handset or if you're a tablet provider at the moment, obviously to save on the cost and the R&D is one reason. Another reason is the apps that are going to be there for it. But I guess if you've got the ability to make your own OS, which is kind of also able to run Android apps, that's an interesting position to be in, because it means you can run these Adobe Air apps, which could end up being quite swish, but without losing the ability to run Android apps. I suspect it's more likely the first one, and they just realised, oh bugger, we need to do this, but it'd be nice if it was the second one, and they basically want to make Android Elite or Android Plus, you know.
Well, it's, yeah, I mean, again, I've been saying for a long time that I felt really that RIM have needed really to embrace the Android operating system and to stop trying to cut out what essentially I see as a non-existent niche in the market space. Mm. You know, I think they have to accept that smartphones like, you know, the HTC Desire and the Galaxy and the iPhone have really caught them with their pants down, and just, you know, totally taken them by surprise. And sadly, you know, the email experience, which was supposed to be so corporate and enterprise encompassing, is sadly very lacking. I mean, I've used the BlackBerry email client, and it is a really not a very nice experience trying to set up an email account on that device. It's all a bit kind of obfuscated. And I've said for a while that they really need to stick with the BlackBerry brand, but get Android onto their devices so that they could be able to compete with their hardware device, but still have the level of flexibility and equal kind of functionality that the rest of the market space has got. And it looks like they're choosing not to do that. And I think they're paying a really heavy price for it, because they've got really poor reviews when you look at the playbook on the web. You know, I mean, 2 out of 10 is, you know, if I was the CEO, I'd be sticking my head in a paper bag. That's just, you know, disastrous.
And they've done the unspeakable. They've priced their models to be exactly the same price as the iPad.
Yeah, but mistake.
So basically, you pay the same, and what you don't get is 2 million apps.
You have to deliver if you're gonna charge those kind of prices. It's the only way you're gonna get away with doing so.
Do you want to pay £400 over here or £400 over here, where you don't get email and you don't get any apps?
Let me think about it.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the humorous bit, just to end on a bit of a humorous, funny bit, I think from my perspective, really, was that I think they've just made a whole raft of mistakes here, and I think the compound mistake is now trying to sort that out by paying for a load of television advertising, because people are very well connected, and they will. People will go and buy these devices and then will berate them, I think, especially when they compare them to some of the other things. So I think that money could well be wasted. And the final element, the funny bit, is that, of course, they are also talking about the wonderful document integration they've got, so you can open all the Microsoft documents that come and so on and so forth. And my question is, how? Because how do you get these things onto your device? You know, if people are going to email them to you, because if they are with no email, that's not going to work, is it? So, you know, and I wonder, you know, I don't suppose that Dropbox have written a client for QNX. So that seems to be, you know, I suppose you can only read the documents if you type them up yourself.
Have somebody dictate them to you down the phone.
So I think that's a big from me on the BlackBerry playbook. I think that's just not going to work. But I did say last time that I would also talk about the ViewSonic, which I will in a moment. But I just want to go that, you know, not happy about the playbook. I think it's shocking. That's my final comment. Any final thoughts from you fellas on it?
Just that it's everything about its conception and the way it's been managed since feels a bit desperate, like they're kind of making it up as they go along. And I dare say it will get email in the end, but it feels like they're very much throwing planks and nails on it as they go. And it shows. Maybe they embrace Android fully and like get absorbed by Google, maybe they'll enjoy a bit more traction. But
I think that adding the Android layer could actually be the one thing that saves the ship from sinking on the playbook. Because obviously then it puts it on a par with Android devices, which at the moment it's failing to do. But if I was CEO at BlackBerry, I'd be getting out, you know? While there's still some money left, you know, because their phones are archaic, and every time I get handed a BlackBerry and asked to do something on it, first thing I do is mash the screen and realise, oh no, not on BlackBerrys. You have to use this retarded little kind of knob on the front, which you try and move your mouse cursor around, and it just sort of judders around the screen like you're in 1980 still.
Now I've broken the screen.
It feels like, yeah, that little thing feels like that. It feels like, do you remember, like, I remember as a kid, my mother used to get this deodorant called Mum, and it came with a ball that used to roll around in the top like a roll-on deodorant.
Yeah.
And that's the BlackBerry, isn't it? You have to use the roll-on deodorant, the mini roll-on deodorant button in the middle, like, you know, and a sort of wheeze your finger around on that, trying to navigate with it. You know, it's a shocking experience. I suppose I ought to say, I suppose whilst I'm in the mood to slate things and berate them, I can probably get started on my ViewSonic 7-inch ViewPad, which I think ViewSonic did a really great offer. They put this offer together for this £300 device, £299, and come in a lovely box. I mean, really nicely packaged and well presented, and well thought out. And They offered it, basically you could use it for 30 days, and if you didn't like it, if you were unhappy with it for any reason, send it them back and you'd get the money back. And I've used it for a bit over 30 days, and in fairness to it, I still wouldn't send it back, even if they were still offering me the opportunity to have the money back. I wouldn't send it back because I do quite like it, and it's got a few neat little features that make it really quite nice and quite likeable. But by the same score, I've suffered with it recently at the hands of perhaps the Android marketplace with the app store that's there and apps that are perhaps, you know, inappropriate for that device. And that's really left me with a bit of a bad experience. Problems like the screen not operating in horizontal mode, things like trying as hard as I can to download Firefox browser and it just will not install, no way, no how. It just gives some odd error. And funny, quirky things like the network seems to keep failing and it's wiping the battery out quite quickly now because apps tend to start and even though I go in the background and stop them again, somehow they seem to get themselves started again and then consume all the power and things like that really let the experience down. And of course, I am comparing it against a very difficult yardstick because I've also got an iPad and I've got, you know, a 64 gig iPad with 3G and Wi-Fi, and you know, £800 is a lot more money to pay than £299 for a 7-inch ViewPad. The devices, I can understand. I think that people might find themselves getting into it a little bit and then finding that there's just a few clunky little bits about it that take it really from what was probably a sort of decent 7.5 out of 10 when I first got it, probably down to a 6 now, I'd say, you know, having sort of used it for around about 6 weeks. So that's not kind of giving me, you know, quite what I expected. But Angry Birds on it is absolutely awesome and very addictive, I have to say. And as a device for playing Angry Birds, you can't beat it. So
the view Angry Birds Sonic.
Yeah. Interestingly, their logo actually for the View Sonic is three little birds in the middle of the screen. Three little like birds of paradise. So, you know, maybe there's some relevance to that. I don't know. But anyway, you know, I mean, it'd be interesting to see what you make of it, John, because I've now lent it to you to have a little bit of a play around with, and you can have a mash around with it and see what you think. So maybe in the next show you could comment on the life of the ViewPad 7.
But quite, you know, interesting to compare it to the Motorola Zoom as well.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, that'd be an interesting one. I mean, I think if you've got $299, that's your budget, then, and you want to do, you know, a nice little device, then the ViewPad 7 probably is still worth the money. Most definitely still worth the money. I'm not saying, you know, don't go out and buy one, but, you know, it has got a few rough edges. Now, you've had your Motorola Zoom for a little while. How are you getting on with that?
Yeah, it's quite nice. I mean, if you compare it to the iPad without any apps on, you take both of them as kind of the stock new devices and you haven't gone to the App Store yet, experience is probably reasonably similar. Interestingly, it doesn't feel quite as responsive as the iPad, which is strange because the iPad one that I've got is single core and this device is dual core, yet it still sort of feels like it lags behind a little bit in the responsiveness. But I have to say, for the most part, I think it's not quite as intuitive as the iPad, and it just lacks a few of the little bits of polish. And I'm not sure if that's just because I've become accustomed to the iPad. But on the iPad, things like the mail client, it all nicely fits in boxes, whereas on the Motorola Zoom, the mail client is very much kind of Google Mail. You know, here's a big white screen and thrown in the left here are your folders, and then thrown on the right is the conversation, but the tops don't quite line up exactly. You know, the font sizes are a little bit different, and little things like that, and you think...
The OS, the interface just feels a little bit more cluttered, doesn't it? A bit more like something you'd find on your desktop, as opposed to something you've been used to seeing on something like the iPad, where it's all very spare. It's with a lot of... with more care for the size of your fingers. I found when I was having a go on the Zoom, as you say, slightly more laggy, but still a very pleasant experience. but I ended up hitting, more often than not, hitting the wrong button because it was next to it. It was a bit too close, and I ended up bumping into something else. That's probably all I've got against the interface there.
Little things. Last thing about interfaces, like little things, like the buttons quite often will just be icons, and they won't have, say, a circle around them. Whereas quite often on the iPhone or the iPad, the buttons are kind of buttons, so you know exactly the region where you're allowed to tap in. Whereas on the Android sort of experience, quite often they're just icons that glow, and it's all very nice, but you end up tapping a little bit too far right of the icon, and you're actually tapping on the next one, but you don't really know where one stops and where one starts. So it's tiny little things like that, and I think that it only made the experience for me kind of 2 or 3% not quite as good, but it's noticeable. But I mean, out of the box, the experience is actually, if I got a Zoom, say for Christmas instead of an iPad, I'd be like, yeah, this is still pretty damn good. The marketplace, I think, lets it down a little bit. And when you find the good apps, they're on a par with the apps in the iTunes store. But the problems we were saying earlier plague it. You download this app and you go, oh, that looks pretty good. And then it runs in this tiny kind of 320 by 240 box in the middle. It doesn't scale up or anything. You can't resize it. Or they've written it to only work on one orientation, when really it's something you want to use on the other one. And some apps just make it crash. You know, you tap it and 10 seconds later the error box pops up. And you think, great, I went through all the effort of finding it, downloading it, installing it, saying yes, it can do all this stuff, and then it crashed, so delete it and back to square one again. And you spend another 5 minutes trying to find another one that's comparable, and it does the same thing. You think, oh well, I won't bother.
Yeah, that's the trouble, isn't it? That is the trouble. Well, I think at the end of the day, I mean, we'll see how these things develop. I mean, obviously, I think it's really interesting. What it does demonstrate is it demonstrates Apple's understanding, really, of how to design really kind of great user experiences, because they were first to the market with this, with their iPad device, and they, you know, you sometimes being first into the market means that you set the bar. And of course, when people, like in a game of cricket, when you know you've got to get 100 runs, it's fairly easy to do because you've got something to aim for. Apple seem to have been able to set that bar really high, and the competition are just consistently missing it, which must be a wonderful feeling for them, you know, the guys at Apple, that they've done that. But, you know, no doubt, hopefully these things will get sorted out, and we'll you know, we'll start to see Android really catch up, because I'd hate to see, I don't want to see another, you know, like the last 15 years of totally dominated Microsoft dominated computing environment. I don't want to see a Google or an Apple do that again. I don't think that's good for technology in the round at all. I think we need some, you know, 3 or 4 decent, significant players in there vying for the field to drive things forward and create good innovation. Products and good experiences. Absolutely, Jack. Yeah, genuine innovation.
I was just thinking, I was thinking that one of these days we should really do a show that's just completely hating on Apple to, like, to even things out, where we just, like, find everything we can about them that's wrong and slate them.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's plenty of material for that. I mean, obviously, you know, they're kind of they're almost a Gestapo approach to the marketplace is probably the first place to start, isn't it? You know what I mean? With Steve Jobs being the Führer, and then, you know, its whole kind of controlling ecosystem. So definitely, I think maybe the next At Random we should have a kind of Bite Me Apple section. Well, I know we were going to talk this evening. We've not got into deep thought, and I'm conscious that, you know, we've done an hour and 30 minutes of show here. It just shows you how much this whole tablet mobile device market space is exploding, because we've talked through loads of different things, and we haven't really looked at some of the deep thought things that were on the agenda that we were talking about earlier on. But maybe we'll get an opportunity to look at some of those next time. Maybe some of our listeners have got some ideas they might like us to look at for deep thought. I think one of the things that I wanted to put across was that you know, as just as Jerry does from time to time, sends us some little voiceovers in. I think if people would like to send in some little voiceovers, then just fire us an MP3 with your comments or questions. If you're out there and you've got, you know, a tablet or a mobile device that you've had a particularly good experience with, it'd be really interesting to hear what people think of things like the HTC Desire and the Galaxy. I mean, I hear people say really good things about them. Maybe maybe somebody could do a little review for us and talk about their experience with an ordinary mobile phone in the Android market space. Because, I mean, us three guys, we're all iPhone users. So that, you know, email us your questions or ideas to show at random.org. And of course, if you've got a smartphone, then record something and fire it on as an attachment on MP3, and we can play it on the show, and we can respond to it as well. So that'd be pretty good. I've got one more thing just to say before we kind of sign off, and that was that I went down to Maplin, and I'd been looking for, with the advent of the Asus ePad Transformer, I got very excited about this idea of being able to plug your tablet to a keyboard and almost have like a little netbook thing. And I'd tried a couple of, like the little Apple keyboard with the iPad and stuff, but I really wanted a keyboard, a nice little keyboard to go with my iPad. And I happened to be wandering around the Maplin shop and found this little case, which is like a leather case with a built-in Bluetooth keyboard, and it allows you to do all the things you could do with your normal iPad leather case, except there's this little Bluetooth keyboard in there, which I have to say, this is an oddity, because my experience started off and I initially went, oh no, why have I spent my money on this? This feels really bad. And then after a couple of uses of it, I've thought, wow, this is really good. My first experience when I touched the keyboard was it felt a little bit like a ZX Spectrum, a bit rubbery and cheap, but I've got used to that now, the feel of it, and actually I'm quite accepting of that. I also found that the keyboard, because it was Bluetooth, it seemed to keep disconnecting itself, and I had to keep going back into the settings and reconnecting it. And then by accident, when I was using the Notepad app, I realised that it puts itself to sleep, and when you press a key, it automatically reconnects, and you have to wait like half a second, and then it'll put the character up on the screen. It hasn't disconnected itself at all. And having got used to that, I've found it really invaluable. You can just, you know, flip the thing open, and off you go, type your email and so on and so forth. And it's only £39, £39.95 in Maplin, the iPad keyboard leather case. So recommendation on that. I give that an 8 out of 10. Really good little app. Anyway, that's enough from me. So it's good night from me. I hope you've enjoyed the show.
Cool. Thanks for listening. It's good night from me.
I'm Jackson Matthews, and you stay classy, San Diego.